Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
Hey there, I'm Lisa Brault.
Johnny's Dunbugger.
I love how Brian always says, hey there. Hey ho. Wait, so who said hey ho? Hey ho.
Hi ho.
Yeah. Kermit the Frog. That's who said that.
Kermit the Frog.
And
here.
You're wearing green today, so it's perfect. It's perfect.
I am. We've got a fun episode for you, as always, coming up in just a bit. We'll check in with Isaac Musgrave, someone that we here at WIL will know very well. He's done lots of TV production work for us. Now he's doing lots of TV production work for fun sporting events, such as the national championship game that just happened this week. I think he'll be in Texas for NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing lots of fun stuff. We'll find out all about that coming up in just a bit. John has a running-related rivalry for us in our rivalry segment this week. We'll have our status update, of course. We'll also talk about overbearing sports parents.
That could be a segment every week.
Yeah, right? It really
we
could
talk
be.
About it.
Father and son Ball, who I think is kind of spearheading this segment this week. Of course, the player for UCLA, LeVar, or is it LeVar the dad? I always forget who's who.
Lonzo is one of the sons, the one who is currently.
Yes, Lonzo's the son.
Oh, yeah, we can get into
LeVar is the dad. We'll get into that here in just a little while. And, of course, our status update, as always, coming your way as well. But first, just a quick check in on a busy week in sports.
That NCAA men's championship war.
Foul Fest 2017.
And then the women's championship was such a gigantic letdown because UConn had. The big thing was South Carolina, right? Upsetting UConn?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it's kind of.
No, it was Mississippi State.
Yeah, Mississippi State.
South Carolina won.
Wait. South Carolina won the title.
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. Mississippi State upset UConn in overtime in the last second shot. And then, like, the championship game was like, oh, yeah. We got to do that.
It was an okay game, and then the team that beat UConn lost in the championship game.
But there was controversy.
Oh, sure.
In that game, because the what do they call her, itty bitty, the player who made the winning shot in the UConn game, didn't play at all in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, apparently she just was not having a good game, and the coach just decided that his best chance to win was to play the backup point guard. Didn't work out.
Right.
They lost.
And, like, I get it. And she was very deferential to the coach. Like, yeah, coach, I wasn't having a good game. Coach made that decision. That's fine. But I think just, you know, in the social media universe where people love to have opinions. I don't know if you know this, but they love to have opinions on social media. And they would have done something differently. I did not know that was part of the backstory. I wasn't watching the game, the final game, that closely. I was just spent from the semifinal game. So, but that was interesting. And that's. Coaches always have to make those kinds of decisions, and they're not always easy and often are misinterpreted by armchair coaches.
Yes, yes, indeed. So
anyway.
Basketball championships are in the books. North Carolina, woo-hoo, wins the title over Gonzaga. And tell me if you've heard this story before. Team with one loss gets all the way to the championship game, loses to North Carolina in a game dominated by fouls.
I'm making that emoji face of, like, holding my chin and going,
Yeah, I think Illini fans are very familiar with that particular scenario.
Well, and actually, John Gassaway, who was a previous guest here on the Bandwagon, was tweeting about this very thing during the game.
Yes.
So, the
interesting.
That large Polish fellow, really, if he would have made a few more shots, I think Gonzaga would have had a much better. I don't know if you watched the game, he was not good from 2 feet out, but I guess he had his eyeball poked out in the previous game.
Ooh, that's not fun.
Something like that. I don't.
No, it looked.
Was it oozing a bit?
It just took him down right away. Like, it would take a lot to take down a guy that big, and it was his eye, but it's your eye. So it's not an ankle or a knee. It's like he got scratched in the eye. I guess the tall Polish fellow, is that what we're going to call him now? What did you call him? The large, tall, big? They gave him like a special contact lens or something. Like in previous years, you may have just put on a set of goggles and called it good.
Karnowski, by the way.
Karnowski, right. They gave him a special contact lens. And I thought it was really I wish they would have won because a lot of family from Poland was there.
Yeah.
To see – and, like, when he went down with the cornea scratch or whatever he had, like, they kept showing the dad. And that wasn't Isaac's shot, by the way, them showing the dad all the time. And the dad would just look like – somebody took my boy down. Who do I fight? You know, like it was, he just looked very concerned. And it's like that thing about parents, and we'll talk about parents, but like he was just a concerned parent.
Yeah, absolutely. So basketball in the books for another year on the college side.
And you're wearing green, and today starts a sports tradition like no other.
Yes, the Masters gets going on today, Thursday.
This is a lot of Jim Nantz this week.
Yeah.
Much Nantz. Have you guys, did you guys see the picture of my brother with Jim Nantz?
I did.
I tweeted it.
Yes.
So my favorite ads of this entire NCAA tournament were, unfortunately, the ones with Charles Barkley and Spike Lee.
Yes.
And Samuel Jackson, mainly because the food spread that they had in the TV area, they were different every time, and they were amazing. I was like, I need screenshots of these so that I can recreate these food spreads.
Well, it's Barkley. He knows how to eat.
Right. And so, but then there's the one where they're in the airport and they're arriving at Phoenix, and then and then Jim Nantz is there getting selfies. And I was like, I know somebody who's had a selfie with Jim Nantz, and it was my brother.
Darn you, Jim Nantz, and your rugged good looks and velvety voice.
That's right. And so I tweeted that picture out. So if anybody wants to see my brother with Jim Nantz like 5 years ago, I can direct people to that. Just follow us on Twitter.
Hello, friends.
Yeah.
And then, of course, which Lisa is really excited about, the start of the baseball season.
She's fired up. She can't stop talking about it.
Which was Sunday night, which, you know,
it's okay.
She had like 3 weeks where we didn't talk about the Cubs. And now we can talk about them again all the time.
Well, and it's fine because it's a thing. And I don't hate baseball, but
I know.
But I like talking about the fact that there's 175 million games a year and it just takes up so much oxygen, especially in this town because we're right square in the middle of like Cubs and Cards country. So it's all right. I like baseball. It's just I'm sort of my time is going to be taken up this spring and summer with MLS soccer.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, who cares?
Well, there's plenty of days where there's not MLS soccer. You can watch a baseball game.
It's true. And but there's also tennis. We're coming up into French Open, Wimbledon, the other most wonderful time of the year when there's a lot of
tennis. When all those
tennis.
Major tournaments get over, baseball will still be going.
God, it's amazing. I mean, really, I should be grateful, I guess. Baseball's always there for me.
It's like just
a
warm blanket. It's just there to comfort you.
Well, and we were talking off the air about how since the Cubs went all the way to the World Series and it was into November, the offseason was not that long for those of us who really followed this year, although it seemed like an eternity to me.
You know, it's so interesting, too, is like so for the Cubs and for Cubs fans like you guys, like the season ran super long and then it ended like on the most positive, amazing, highest, incredible note ever. And then I love NCAA basketball season. I love the tournament so much. I just love it. Love watching all the games, love speculating about all the winnings, which, by the way,
we did horribly.
I did fine. I came in second.
Oh, that's right.
I came
North
in
Carolina
second because our boss, Moss Bresnahan, picked North Carolina, and so did I to win, and he beat me by 1 point. Just wait till next year. But anyway, the final game was such a letdown after this tournament that was full of amazing games, both the men's and the women's, and then the final games were just such a letdown. It's like, I hate ending the season this way. I want it. You guys got to end Cubs season in the most amazing fashion possible. Basketball did not end amazingly for me.
Yeah. There were really good games in the semifinals, too.
Yeah.
That's what's unfortunate about
it.
And then the final game.
So
just
much. Oh, man, it was awesome to see those games in both the men's and the women's side. And then it was just sort of a wash after that. But whatever.
Also, this week, the never-ending train that is Illini sports.
Oh, man.
You know, since the last time we talked, Illinois has a coach, which was great, and then all the recruits were going to stay, which was great, and then the number one recruit, Jeremiah Tillman, decides not to stay.
Maybe.
Come on, he's not staying.
Well, you don't know.
We'll see if he ends up in Missouri, Quanzo Martin.
Well, the interesting thing about that, if I understand the rules correctly, because Tillman did sign a letter of intent, Illinois can put some conditions on his release if they so choose.
I know that that happens a lot, especially for transfers, but does it ever happen in these cases?
It doesn't happen very
often. It seems like it would be a bad precedent to send, especially if you want those kids to sign letters of intent early on. Anyway, stay tuned to the continuing saga that is Illinois men's basketball. Illinois women's basketball has a new coach as well.
Yeah, new coach, Nancy Fay, Hall of Fame coach from Division III Washington University in St. Louis, has won 700 games, I think, in her career down there. Five national titles, 10 Final Fours at the Division III level. Josh Whitman, the athletic director, of course, worked with her when he was the AD at Washington University
right.
a few years ago.
Right.
So they have that connection. I'll be interested to see how that works. It's a big jump from the Division III level to Division I, but it's obvious that she knows how to coach. I think the question when you make that jump always is recruiting and how she'll do there.
It's recruiting, it's rules, it's scholarships, it's in academics. And, you know, we've taken up these topics of discussion before and letters of intent and how complicated college sports are, like especially for the big sports. And maybe I'll find that episode and refer back to it because that's a discussion that has been ongoing for us, I think, is just dealing with Division I bureaucracy and the you know, the moving parts all the time. So, yeah, that'll be a whole new world for her. I would love to bring her on sometime.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah.
Be a very interesting conversation. Also in Illini sports, I got to moonlight.
Oh man, I was going to set you up. I was going to set you up, and you took it away.
Well, go ahead, John.
No, now it's going to seem. I was going to say, and spring sports started, and our own Brian Mull. Now it doesn't mean anything. Anyway, tell us your story, Brian.
Well, I got an email a few weeks ago from Zach, who handles event management for Illinois softball games. Apparently, Mike Kuhn, who does PA announcing for Illinois softball, was out of town. He goes to the women's NCAA basketball Final Four every year. He was down there doing that. Tim Sinclair, who does PA announcing for the men's basketball games here at Illinois, he's kind of the backup for a lot of other sports. He was out of town doing a Chicago Fire game Saturday.
I love how you point at me when there's a soccer mention.
Yes,
you point at me.
Absolutely, yeah. I point at Lisa.
All right,
so apparently, I'm third string. So I got the email from Zach asking me if I was available to do PA announcing, and I said sure. I'll give that a shot. I was thinking about it. Obviously, I've done lots of radio play-by-play over the years. The last time I think I did public address announcing was like back in early 2000 when I was living in St. Louis. I did some PA for Merrimack Community College basketball.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I think that's the last time I'd done any public address. But it was fun. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And plus,
do they give you food up there? Like, do you have a hot dog and some soda and some grape now and laters?
You get a coupon for two items from the concession stand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was enjoyable. And Illinois was playing Minnesota.
The Gophers. Also, you're looking at me for that, too.
That's, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of Lisa connections here. In
John
this
lived in Minnesota.
I'm an alum of the Golden Gophers.
He's a gopher. He's an actual gopher.
Yeah.
Undergraduate?
No. I can't hear undergraduate there.
Okay.
They're grad school. But anyway.
All right. Very good. So John actually is a gopher. But
don't ask me anything about who their coach is or anything.
No, that's fine. Minnesota actually has a really good softball team this year. Coming into the series with Illinois, they were 28-2.
Dang.
And ranked number 6 in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Both of their losses had come to another top 10 team, Washington, earlier in the season. But Saturday, the Illini came through, and they beat the Gophers 4-3. They scored the winning run in the bottom of the 7th off of Minnesota's ace pitcher, Sarah Groenewegen, who had an ERA of like 0.55 or something like that coming into the game. So that was fun.
Way to rough her up, guys, girls.
Yeah, yeah, that was good. So Minnesota took 2 out of 3, but hey, the Illini got one.
That's good.
And we get a little inside scoop into PA announcing, and now we're about to get an inside scoop into behind the scenes of the NCAA championship.
That's right. Isaac Musgrave coming up next here on The Bandwagon.
Okay. Okay, so to me, one of the most fascinating things about athletics in general, and in particular the NCAA basketball tournament, is the camera work and all the work that goes in into the behind-the-scenes preparation for the tournament. And I've always been interested in this. And then lo and behold, Brian, I found out that I work with somebody on occasion who actually has not only has access to this kind of behind-the-scenes information, he is a very active participant. And so today we're going to talk to our friend and occasional WILL collaborator Isaac Musgrave, who is fresh off of a—I'm not even sure how long Isaac was gone, but fresh off a stint as a camera operator for the NCAA tournament. And actually, I think also the Big Ten tournament. So we're going to ask him about that. Isaac, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
And Isaac, where are you today?
Today, I am in Illinois. I'm home today, just off the Final Four. So it's good to be home for a little bit.
Yeah, well, welcome back. I know that you were gone off and on for weeks at a time, and started off at the Big Ten tournament. Is that where you were before the big dance?
Actually, I started with regular season games. So I started back in February. But basically, yeah, the Big Ten was where it really kind of kicks off. You know, we do the Big Ten tournament. And then that's when March Madness starts. And then I'm basically from event to event for roughly 3 weeks straight. So it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. So this is so weird to me that I actually know somebody who gets to be a huge part of this. So how long have you been doing it? How did you get started working with them?
Well, I've done the Final Four and the whole tournament the last 2 years, at least in the complete tournament. I've done bits and pieces games here and there, like at the Big Ten tournament, for about the last 3 years. And just a friend and mentor of mine, he's been doing the package for about 15 years. So he kind of got me into it, and it's all about who you know. So that's kind of how it works out.
So what is your role when you're operating the camera? What are you doing?
Yeah. So basically, what we are doing is the robotic cameras above the rim. So basically, they're mounted on top of the shot clock. And during the game, we can do everything from graphic shots, where we'll do some kind of move from the ceiling, or, we'll do some play-by-play coverage. Our cameras are always recorded. Just like all of the cameras at the Final Four, every camera is recorded the entire time. So we're also used heavily for replays, telestrators, things like that.
Okay, so can you describe for me for the tournament? So you're getting ready for a game. You've arrived on site. Can you talk about your setup? How long it takes you to get set up for a day's work or 2 days' work for games? How many cameras you have? Stuff like that. Like how huge of a deal is it?
It gets bigger and bigger as the weeks go on. For example, once the Big Ten tournament starts, that's really where everything kicks off. Before that, like a regular season game, there's approximately 10 or 12 cameras, and it depends on which crew you're working with. So whether you're working with the A crew, the B crew, it depends on how many cameras they get. But basically, when we get there and set up, it usually takes 1 day to build and set up everything. And that's not just the robotic cameras above the rim. That's the whole set, everything. That's the stat tables, that's running all the fiber optics, that's checking everything, that's getting the A unit, which is where they're going to direct the show out of, which is a big semi. Mm-hmm. It's a production semi. That's getting the A unit and the B unit talking, all the graphics built, 1 day. And then the next day we come in and you shoot, and then you're out. You shoot and tear down the next day. That's for a regular season game.
Okay.
For the tournament, it's a little longer, and it gets longer as you go, just because you get more and more elements in. So the Big Ten tournament, that one's kind of difficult because there are multiple broadcast organizations that work it through the week. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I work primarily with CBS, but the Big Ten tournament started, I think, on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And I think Big Ten Network, they had stuff in there all the way through the full Big Ten tournament. But as things went along, they would break down some of their stuff. And in the end, all they had left was a table. And then ESPN, yeah, like basically a broadcast table, you know, some talent, stuff like that. And then ESPN, they came in and they would tear out all the Big Ten Network stuff. Basically, they pack up their stuff. ESPN puts their stuff there. Then on like Saturday morning for the Big Ten tournament, we came in to build our stuff. We had to build and shoot on the first day because there was no time. So we came in at like 4:30 or 5 in the morning and then built until about noon. And then after that, we took lunch, had our camera meeting, and that was it.
So basically, so when you're doing this, you're working for CBS, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
As a contract.
Yeah. Okay, as a contractor. Okay, so as part of that, is it kind of an exclusive thing where you can't do that for anybody else like BTN or ESPN, or does it just work better to work for one network like that?
Well, it's more about who has the contract. So for robotics specifically, there are basically two main companies that provide robotic cameras for most of the broadcasts that you see. There's Fletcher, which they do primarily all the basketball, hockey, baseball, and some football. And then there's RoboVision, which is who I work for. And basically, RoboVision gets the contract, and then they contract me, and CBS contracts RoboVision. Mm-hmm. But I could work for other networks. The main thing is it just depends on who RoboVision has the contract with.
Okay, so they have the contract with CBS, and does the other company then have the contract like with BTN and ESPN, for example?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Interesting.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically about the NCAA tournament. So you were traveling quite a bit, and can you talk about what that's like? Because you came home in between occasionally, right? You had these really intense periods of working, and then you were home for a couple of days, and then you were off again. Like, what is the schedule like and the travel? And are you by yourself? Are you with somebody else? Is somebody else from here, like from this area, working with you? Like, what's that like?
So it's definitely a challenge because basically once March Madness starts, the first, second round, I am gone solid for 3 weeks until it's over. Basically, I did not come home at all. I left on the 15th. Mm-hmm. I just got home yesterday. Didn't come home at all. So now I did travel with someone, basically starting the Big Ten Network. We had a second operator, and he's just another guy that I work with in RoboVision. He's not from the area. But the travel is a challenge because they don't necessarily know where you're going to go. So, for example, at the start of the tournament, the Big Ten tournament, when we got done with that, we had to pack all of our equipment up, all of our gear, and put it on a truck to be shipped, but we didn't know where it was going. because we didn't know if we needed to book flights or where we were going. We had tentatively booked flights to Tulsa because that was kind of the rumor that we might go to Tulsa for the first and second round. At least our robos would go there. But we didn't know for sure. And we didn't even find out until we finished the tournament, I think, on a Sunday. And it was like Monday around 1 o'clock that I found out that we were going to Tulsa. So, and it was the same kind of thing at the end of the first and second round. You know, they thought tentatively we might go to Kansas, but it was, again, the same thing. We were waiting until the last night, which was, I think, Sunday. Yeah. So we were waiting again on Sunday until, like, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Then they finally said, "Yep, you guys are going to Tulsa."
So somebody from another part of the organization is doing the logistics planning for that, right? And you're just sort of waiting.
Yeah. Okay. We're just waiting. And what makes it really kind of difficult is CBS and Turner are partnered on it. So basically, CBS and Turner Sports Network, or whatever TBS TNT. They partnered together, I think it was a couple of years ago, to buy the rights to broadcast the NCAA, the Final Four, and do the tournament for like 15 years or something like that. There was a big contract, and it was a huge amount of money. So that's what makes it difficult, too, is that Turner has their way they want to do things, which is totally fine. You know, they would naturally want to use the people they're comfortable with and they're familiar with, their own trucks, all kinds of stuff like that. And CBS has people that they use, different trucks, you know, different operators, different people. So, and it kind of comes down to which company is going to pick which location. So, you know, like which network is going to do which location. Like, for example, in Tulsa, we, the first, I think, four games that we did the first day for the first round, we were on True TV. CBS crew but True TV, you know. And then I think we ended up, like our final game was, I think, on TBS or TNT. Same thing, though. CBS crew. So there's a lot of there's a lot of politics and a lot of stuff that goes into it that's, you know, behind the veil that I don't get to see. You know, but yeah, it's a lot of logistics, and I can't imagine the headache it is to try to book a whole bunch of people flights on like a Monday morning for Wednesday.
Right. So when you guys got to Phoenix, how many cameras are you setting up for that? That's like the big show, right? So,
yeah,
so
yeah.
How many total cameras, including my favorite, I love your work, Isaac, my favorite camera is the one that tracks alongside the court. That's like sort of, I love that view. I would watch a whole games like that if I could. How many cameras are set up total in the arena?
Cameras total. It's kind of tricky because there's a couple of different things, right? So there's the pregame show, there's a whole different crew for that, and then there's our show. So like TBS did TNT and TBS did the pregame show. They probably had somewhere around 10 or 12 cameras, including, you know, their own jib and a studio setup and all this. And then for the actual show, I think we were right around 20 cameras.
Wow. So yeah. And where are you when all of this is happening? So the game is going on. Where are you and your colleagues?
So basically, when the game goes on, we have to build an operating room because the cameras we use are remote robotic cameras. So we build an operating room, and we usually try to be relatively close to the court in case there was some need to check a power cable or data signal or something like that. So we were, I don't know, maybe about 120 feet off to the side of the court underneath the bleachers.
Okay. And that, I think we'll post a picture on the website. I think I received a picture from that vantage point, actually. And I don't know where I thought you were, but I was surprised to learn that that's exactly where you were. One other thing that you mentioned while we were messaging back and forth, while I was totally disrupting your workday, because I was just so excited that you were there, I said, hey, I've seen some Isaac shots. And then you said, yeah, like you said something in the text message that made me think that you guys are sort of like hoping to see more of your work on camera. Like, is there competition between camera operators for the number of shots that you get during a game? And how is that decided?
Well, I mean, as far as like what, you know, what gets on, that's really dependent on the producer. For example, when you have so many cameras, I mean, the director for the show is, he's phenomenal. I think one of the best in the business. But, you know, just you have so many cameras, it's really, really hard not to have the same shot as somebody else. You know, for example, they were on the court alone. There are 11 high-speed cameras. You know, so usually, like, the replays or going to commercial or whatever, they usually like to use one of the high-speed cameras for that because it's a great look. You get great reactions and super slow-mo. But, you know, when you get 11 of those just on the court alone, not including the up cameras or anything like that, it definitely makes it a challenge. And of course, we all want to see, I mean, everybody will say, I don't really care if I see my stuff on there. That's not true. Right? we all want to see our work on there, you know, especially one of the packages or the rollout or one shining moment, you know. It's more of a point of pride, you know. It's like, especially when you're shooting stuff, and at the Final Four, like, everybody that's there, these are the guys that are doing, you know, the A crew. They're doing the Super Bowl. They're doing the Olympics. They're doing, you know, the Masters. Like, most of the guys from this crew took a charter to the Masters.
Okay.
You know, I mean, right there. So, I mean, these are guys that are, they're the top of the field. So, yeah, you definitely want to see your work on there, especially it being such a big show. You know, but ultimately, who decides what gets on? It comes down to, you know, the director and the producer. And the pace of the game, you know, if it's a slower paced game, they can get it more replays. You know, so then you're getting two or three replays before you come back to play. But if it's, you know, like it was the other day where they're doing a lot of trips just right up and down and no dead balls, nobody's walking it up the court. There's not a lot of timeouts. There's not really a lot of time to get in replays.
Two questions come to mind. First, did you get a shot in one shining moment this year?
I believe we did, yes.
Okay. And what was the best shot of yours that made it on the air during this year's tournament?
During this year's tournament? Well, there was a There was one we had that was really, really a good look that showed an injury that nobody else had. So I would say that was a kind of our best one. It was one of the North Carolina players. I don't think it was Barry. It was one of the other players, but he was coming down for to do a layup or something. And this year, our cameras up top, they were 4K cameras. They hadn't done that before. So they were 4K cameras, which allowed the operator to go ahead and actually like crop in and create a digital zoom. And you could see the guy's ankle just going. I would say that was probably the best shot that we had during the tournament.
Of an injury.
Yeah, I mean, and it's as terrible as it sounds, you know, it's like, but I guess, you know, the way I see it is the best shot to me is a shot that no other camera has.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I can see that. So as we start to wrap up here, I'm curious, I would like for you to tell us something that will blow our minds regarding the work that goes into televising these games. Like, so what would blow just a regular layperson about what it is that you guys are doing? Or it doesn't even have to be about necessarily your work, but just about the tournament or the final game. Like, feel free to dish. You can, you know, you can talk about all the on-air personalities or whatever. Like, is there something funny that we should know? Or what's happening behind the scenes that is just mind-boggling?
I would say what happens behind the scenes that's mind-boggling is probably the amount of the amount of replays they do so quickly. Like, I am blown away. I mean, like, one shining moment, that's not ready. Like, at the end of the game, that's not ready.
Yeah.
There are people behind the scenes that are madly just cutting together this amazing highlight thing, or even the rollouts or whatever. The tape people, I would say. Just the fact that, you know, those replays, like, they just call it and they know where to go so quickly. And there's somebody back there that's tracking every camera that has to cue those right and has to do that. Like, I think that's what's amazing, at least to me. The other thing that's amazing, I think, is I would probably just say just the director's ability to do it. I mean, you know, there's one director and one producer. And just to get all those shots in to work with the Skycam and everybody he has to talk to and coordinate with. And he never gets upset. He remains calm like the whole time. You know, he's just as cool as a cucumber. And, you know, I just think that's phenomenal.
Before we let you go, Isaac, what's up next for you? When will we see your work next?
Well, if you're watching NASCAR at the Texas Motor Speedway this weekend, you would see some there. So that's the next thing for me is tomorrow I get on a flight and I go to Texas to go do the Fox race for the Texas Motor Speedway.
I actually have one more burning question, and then we're going to let you go. Did you find a good donut place in Tulsa?
Oh, we most certainly did. Yes, we did. In Tulsa, we found it was called Hertz Donuts.
Okay.
And it was phenomenal.
Awesome. Good to know. I was kind of worried about you and the whole like food and eating and touristy sides of things we'll have to get to another time. But thank you so much, Isaac Musgrave, for telling us what it was like to be a camera operator during the NCAA basketball tournament. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Isaac.
No matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
Thanks again to Isaac Musgrave for joining us to give us a behind-the-scenes look at what happens at the Final Four, NASCAR, all sorts of fun stuff with those robotic cameras that you see mounted on the backboard and everything. That was fun. And
we're going to have pictures on the website.
We will.
Yeah,
we will.
So plenty.
And John Steinbacher had to step out of the room, but he's back now.
That's right. We have other jobs and sometimes duty calls.
That's right. So John is back. Next up, it's time to talk a little bit about what we call OSPs, overbearing sports parents. Those kind of came to our attention. The latest edition, LeVar Ball, has made lots of headlines in the last few months for all sorts of comments he's made, including the fact that he could beat Michael Jordan one-on-one back in his prime, which everyone has pretty much said is bunk. But
well, didn't he play like in college and didn't start?
Yeah, I mean, he was okay. He was a fine basketball player, but not. He never played professionally or anything like that, at least not at the highest level. And, of course, his son Lonzo, star for UCLA, probably a lottery pick in the upcoming draft.
Probably a top five, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe even top two, top three.
Yeah, yeah. So very good player, a one and done there at UCLA. So that's kind of what brought this to our attention. But
yeah, he's been very loud and vocal speaking up on behalf of his son and how he's better than Steph Curry. And also being on a lot of he's made appearances on lots of sports shows because, hey, look, we're talking about it. But yeah, it's easy to say, oh, bring him on and say, oh, he's so loud and obnoxious. But then you get the good ratings. And I think we saw a picture. I forget what show it was on, but it's like him talking. And Lonzo's in the background, and he just has this, like, oh, gosh.
There's my dad again.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is nothing new. There's a long, long history of overbearing sports parents. I think I pulled up a few lists, but some ones that stand out, obviously, are Earl Woods, Tiger Woods' father. Richard Williams, who is his father of Venus and Serena.
Mm-hmm.
Marinovich's father, who, if you don't know who Todd Marinovich is, look that up, but that's crazy. So,
one of the biggest NFL busts at quarterback in recent, well, not so recent memory. Back in the
90s. Who is Maravich? What am I thinking there?
Pete Maravich?
Oh, yeah.
Is that what you're thinking of?
Pistol Pete, yes. Anyway, so there's this long history of parents, and it's not just it seems to be fathers a lot, but there's also mothers. In fact, I can't remember the guy's name. There's actually an NBA player now whose mother McGee, is that his last name? Whose mother was a WNBA player who is super overbearing. So, it tends to be the father, but it's not exclusively the fathers who are overbearing.
No, I was going to say, like, whole families can be really overbearing, especially in the college recruitment process. In fact, I was lurking on Reddit yesterday in the UIUC subreddit, and there was a whole very predictable thing about this letter of intent thing, and there was this speculation about
fault.
The family. And.
Yeah.
And the parents do get really involved in the drama. They're also trying to help their kid make decisions, whether or not they are decisions that will most benefit the kid or they will most benefit the parents or the family. That's a different discussion every single time, I think. It's not – like you said, it's not just the dads. It can be entire families. And especially now with social media, I think it's very easy to get people all whipped up into – all kinds of family frenzies.
Yes, indeed.
Family-friendly frenzies.
Now, of the three of us, John and Lisa are both parents. John, your kids are young enough. They haven't really done a lot of organized sports yet, have they?
Not successfully.
What is success? Please define success. Completing a season? Participating?
So far, one of my daughter played soccer 1 year. And it didn't go well for lots of reasons. And then not that she's not interested, but whatever. And then they both have taken tennis lessons. But
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at her age, too, kids playing sports that are outside, they're still picking dandelions.
Oh, yeah.
While practice or games are happening. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. I mean, unless you're an overbearing sports parent and you have your kid in, like, club sports at the age of eight, which some people do.
Where do you fall in the sports parents barometer?
So my sports parent days are over. I'm in a different position from John. My kids are 24 and 18. So I would say I was not overbearing in terms of leaning hard on my kids. And my younger kid, my daughter, played soccer all through high school and played some traveling soccer too. So she, of the two, was by far more involved in a team sport. My son played a little bit of soccer and he ran some cross country, but sports were not his biggest thing. Whereas my daughter played soccer and that was her only sport. So we did not pressure her to play multiple sports. She chose soccer pretty early on, but she's very tall. She would have been an excellent basketball player and a superb volleyball player, I think, if she had played, if she had wanted to play. I sort of tentatively put that feeler out for her, and one day she just looked at me and she was like, I don't want to play any sport that involves me using my hands. Okay, fair enough. So soccer it was, and she was a very good soccer player. I think she could have taken it all the way into college easily if she had wanted to. I think she had some injuries that definitely contributed to her maybe not being able to play as much as she would have liked. And then academics just kind of took over for her. So, but while she was playing, I yelled a lot at referees and would get pretty grumpy with certain coaches at times. I like to yell at referees because my husband is also a soccer official. So I would be overbearing in terms of my enthusiasm, let's say. It was never directed at the kids, my daughter. I was content to just sort of sit back and let her do her thing, but I got very involved in watching the games. And I pace. I can't sit. The most hilarious thing that my in-laws could have given us was a set of chairs for games. They used them more than we did by a long shot, because Jim would just stand there with his arms crossed watching the game, and I would just pace back and forth. I like would wear a little path. Now, I've also been a coach. I coached some Park District soccer with my husband last fall, and that was I love the girls. Their parents were all very interesting. You had varying levels of involvement from none to sort of strange. And so that was interesting to sort of experience parents at Park District. This is like we practice twice a week and play on Saturdays. So I think there's overbearing at every level and at every commitment level for the sports too. But in terms of like me personally, I just was shouty with the refs and would grumble about the coaches. And I really like breaking down games afterward with my daughter and my husband. We really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. I don't know how much the other two really enjoyed, including me in that conversation. I don't miss that. Now I can just enjoy the games. I think it's weird though, as a parent, especially if you've played the sport or you like sports, you get pretty invested in what's going on out there. So
yeah, definitely.
So that's your future, John.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna have a problem with the other parents mostly. That seems to be how it goes for me. Like, the kids are just kids,
right?
And then you just see these other people, and they're like, geez.
Well, and there is that, I guess. The high school soccer environment was pretty great, I thought, because at my daughter's high school, anybody could play. There were no cuts made to teams, so it was just everybody was on the team. Club soccer, a whole other story, especially when you just got the feeling that some of these parents were very content to create ponytailed Alex Morgan soccer robots. I mean, that's literally what was going on. On one of the teams that my daughter was on, I just felt like, it was impossible to get to know the girls. They were just – and their parents were at every practice. They'd be like – these are high school girls and parents are at practice. That to me is just like
– yeah, it's a little much.
That's a lot. Or they'd wait with their cars idling in the parking lot for the entire practice.
I'm most looking forward to when my kids are old enough that I don't have to be there during practice.
So, yeah. But some people – I don't know. I mean, even at the level that my husband coaches at, he's coaching solo again this spring because I'm just too busy. Fifth through eighth grade girls, a lot of parents at these practices for Park District. And I'm thinking,
I'm going to the bar.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you guys my idea for a bar at Soccer Planet, which is our indoor soccer facility here? So there needs to be a bar, and it needs to be called the Soccer Widow.
Yeah.
And I will run it.
That
so if you're
awesome,
listening,
actually.
Soccer Planet, I'd like to open Soccer Widow adjacent to your building or as part of your enterprise. Just let me know.
She's waiting for your phone call.
Yeah. So anyway, parents.
Yeah. And this is also one where I'm sure that'll come up again. It's sort of like letters of intent where it's complicated and web we all weave. But hey, that's how it goes.
Well, I also think like overbearing parents 30 years ago, did it look the same?
I don't know if there were as many. They were around. Like that's about when Todd Marinovich's dad was prominent. He was like one of the first ones I really remember.
Well, and I think probably there's been overbearing sports parents forever, but they have a lot more tools now, you know, with the traveling teams and the AAU and all that stuff and spending more money, and kids are getting into it much younger, and it's not recreation, it's serious.
Well, and that's a whole other topic of conversation is the money, but then you have other sports that maybe don't cost as much money, but the kid is really good and the whole family is depending on this kid's success, and so that's a whole other type of... There's like this financial success aspect to it in some sports for some folks, and then there's just the prestige aspect of it, or this is going to be one piece of the puzzle for my kid getting into Harvard or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then who'd want to play soccer at Harvard? You want to go to like Cal or something, you know, or Wake Forest or Stanford. They have great soccer teams, you know.
Sure.
So I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, we'll travel down some other forks in that road, I'm sure, down the road. But there's a brief conversation anyway about overbearing sports parents. Next up, it is rivalry time. John Steinbacher, what do you have?
Well, this is not a long, long years and years rivalry, but it is a pretty famous one in terms of running.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the most famous male runner of all time?
Jim Ryan.
Damn it.
Did he get it?
No. No. Who is the most famous mile runner of all time?
It's that one guy.
Bannister?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, this is
Roger Bannister,
famous for being the first human to be on a clock in a sub-4-minute mile. Before he did it, there were a lot of people racing to try and get there, and there was all these rumors like, it's not possible, blah, 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 it's not whatever. He actually had quite a rival who was also at the same time trying to break the 4-minute mile, and his name was John Landy.
Mm-hmm.
John Landy actually beat his time. So Roger Bannister, most famous mile runner of all time, held the record for all of a couple weeks. And then John Landy beat him. And set a time that Roger Bannister never broke, which was 3:58. But the most famous aspect of this rivalry is the year that they both broke the record, they raced in the Empire Games in Vancouver, and the stage was set for one of the greatest races in history between the only two men ever to go for sub-4 at that time. The Miracle Mile, as it was dubbed, didn't disappoint. Landy went out fast, led for most of the race, and everyone knew that Bannister was a great finisher. And he was winning by several meters, but then at the crucial moment, John Landy apparently looked back over his shoulder, and then a few seconds later, Bannister ran right past him and won the race. It was a sub-4-minute mile, but it still didn't even beat Bannister's best time. Anyway, it's famous. So apparently up in Vancouver at this stadium, there's a bronze statue of both of them, and John Landy's like looking backwards. So
what's shooting, yeah.
So a very, very brief rivalry, but very interesting in the fact that Bannister is so famous, and he actually won this race, but John Landy is the one who set the mark that actually lasted. It lasted for 3 or 4 years before anyone beat his mark. And then it's kind of just interesting to see the times because the thinking about the mile, which, you know, now that most of the world doesn't really work on that system, I think it's probably less of a race than the 5K or
10,000 meters,
or even at 1K. But the last time the mile record was broke was 1999.
Hmm.
So it's not really made a lot of movement, and it was 3:43. That's pretty darn
good. That's moving.
Do you think we've talked about this too.
Yeah.
Like, have we reached the limit of fastness? Like, now is it just going to be a matter of milliseconds?
Well, I think anytime you're talking about stuff like that, I think it does get to a point where, yes, there will be people that are faster, but in terms of how much faster, you know.
And whether they want to run the mile versus some of these other more prominent races,
yeah,
too. The one thing that I think is interesting is that the best women's time, or woman's time, depending on how you want to say it, is 4:12, 4:13. So it seems feasible that in the future a woman could run a sub 4 minute mile, certainly. But that one hasn't been broken since 1996. So again, I just don't think there's quite the incentive that there used to be. But it's interesting, and you know, John Landy, I think probably he was seems like he was actually more of a professional runner than Roger Bannister. Roger Bannister was famously a doctor, physician who didn't who was just really an amateur, didn't even really. And it's funny, I watched the video of the race, and at the after they're done, you know, it's just a mile. Bannister like collapses into the arms, and some guy's carrying him, and they're interviewing him afterwards, and he's like, it's just so much different than now today, where like someone, you know, these guys finish. And I know if you run a marathon, it's different, but these guys finish like a 10K, and they're just and they've, you know, they're not like super gassed. They're like, anyway, so this is.
So why are we talking about running, John?
Yeah, I don't know. Brian is going to run the Illinois Marathon, 5K and 10K, I believe. Which
That's right.
Is 2 weeks from this weekend. And then on Wednesday, April 12th.
What's happening then, John?
Well, it's funny you should ask. What a coincidence. WILL is having our spring fun drive, which we are coalescing around the idea of the WRL Marathon, which will be for 26.2 hours, starting at 6:49 a.m. on April 12th, going to
that's when I'm on the air.
9:01 a.m. on April 13th. Brian Moline will be kicking off and the closing leg. So
yeah, I'm the opening leg and the closing leg.
If you like what you hear on this podcast, or if you just like what WILL does in general, we'd love to have your support at willpledge.org, or if you're listening on the app or NPR One, or however you're listening, you can just, you know, click on the donate button. That's the spiel. I don't know if anyone else wants to say anything, but I figure we might as well mention it.
Yeah, absolutely. We should mention it. Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. It's April's kind of big marathon month in general.
Right.
Boston
right.
Marathon, Illinois Marathon, now WILO Marathon.
All three of those things are equal in stature.
Yes.
That's right.
All right, folks. It's time for our status updates to round things out this time. Who wants to go first this week?
I love going first.
All right.
But I have three things, two things I'm going to mention very briefly and one thing that we can talk about or I can just talk about. Thing one. So it was this week we had elections. There were elections everywhere. Mm-hmm. And this week St. Louis voted down the idea of having an MLS franchise in their town. There was a very interesting editorial by a guy named Bernie Miklas. Miklas, okay. I actually really enjoyed what he had to say, even though he was very upset. And I think a lot of what happened in St. Louis is people are just fed up with, like, teams
right,
leaving,
the Rams.
The
away.
NFL really burned them.
Yes. And so it's really unfortunate. I love MLS soccer and would have loved to have seen another team be set up there, especially because there were a lot of things that the team would have done for community stuff. I really would have liked to have seen Minnesota play in St. Louis. It's a lot easier than going all the way up to Minnesota to play or to watch them play or go to the middle of nowhere stadium that is
Toyota Park.
Yeah. So that's an interesting story, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes. But that was one thing that came through on social media, thanks to my brother-in-law, Pete Geegan. Thanks, Pete. Everybody should have an Uncle Pete in their lives, and my kids have an Uncle Pete in their lives. So that's very cool. Anyway, the other thing that came through is just there is a huge sports sex abuse scandal unfolding, and we probably haven't heard about it. We may have touched upon it briefly here, but it is still unfolding, and that's the one about Dr. Larry Nassar, who was the doctor for the USA Gymnastics team and Michigan State. He's been charged with sexually assaulting dozens of girls and women that he's treated over the last 20 years.
Ooh.
Now, the fact that it's not being talked about and like just and that people are not super angry is partially a function of it's not getting that much media attention. But why? Because this is way worse than the Jerry Sandusky stuff. This is way, way worse. So we'll post a link to this article, too. And people should educate themselves, especially parents of children who are in sports is critical. that parents educate themselves about what happens in sports, especially at an elite level. You just you have to be vigilant. That's all I'm going to say about that. The third thing that was actually a social media back and forth, sort of, was when our friend Gino Auriemma, who we've talked about on this show before, he's, of course, the coach of the very storied UConn women's basketball program. He's been there since 1985. He's seen a lot of stuff go up and down. They've won so many games. Everybody loves Gino. And then Gino said, I think it was in a press conference, if I'm not mistaken, somebody asked him a question, and he responded that women don't coach at a high level because they don't want to, just to paraphrase. Not as many women want to coach. So that's bad enough. Okay, and there's a lot to the story, and again, I have many links, but my favorite part of this was his daughter got on Twitter and was like, "Dad, walk it back." Like she went after him on Twitter. I'm actually not sure if he ended up walking it back. There was multiple editorials from all sides, you know, you've got a bunch of dude bros writing about how, you know, it's true, though. I mean, look, they're not applying for the jobs. And to me, there's just so much more there than just that. Athletic directors are primarily male. It's still seen as a male domain. Women are still expected to work and be able to raise families and be the mother. So there has to be support at home. And I'd like to point out that Gino Auriemma was able to have this great family around him because he had somebody at home who was taking care of business while he was doing this very hard thing of coaching at a really high level. I have lots to say about that, but I just want to shout out his daughter for, like, all capsing him on Twitter. It was pretty great.
Yeah, I did see that interaction back and forth between the two of them. That was pretty cool to see. John, what do you have?
We'll keep it fairly negative.
Okay.
That's what social media is, though, isn't it?
I mean, yeah. Another, like, oh, guys, it's just sports. Relax. One of the referees refereed the Kentucky Elite Eight loss to North Carolina. Apparently he has a roofing company, and Kentucky fans found it. And they've been inundating his roofing company with, like, bad reviews, blah, blah, blah. And it seems to keep getting worse and worse. And now there's, like, death threats about the guy.
What?
Apparently on the Kentucky radio broadcast, the UKentucky radio broadcast, they really lit into this particular referee and blamed him for the loss. And I just think, you know, let it go, right? I mean, even if it was something he messed up on, it was a mistake. It's just sports.
Yeah, that's way out of line.
It's way out of line.
Come on.
I actually haven't done enough research to look into whatever, but, you know, these guys are just doing their jobs, and they're not trying to F anybody over.
Yeah, that's not even their full-time thing. Like you said, the guy's a roofing company. That's
right, I know. Like,
job.
That's another interesting thing is, like, NCAA referees who have other jobs. That should be something we talk about. Because don't they get paid enough?
I don't remember what they get paid per game. I mean, I think they do okay. If I remember right, I think you guys will both remember the name Ed Hightower. He was a longtime Big Ten referee.
I know Ed Hightower.
He was
the superintendent of the Edwardsville School District.
Yeah.
And he and my father-in-law didn't get along because my wife's house as a kid was right next to them, and he wanted to buy some property for them for a sidewalk and blah, blah, blah. I won't get into that. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't realize there was a personal history there.
My father-in-law and Ed Hightower used to give each other the eyes all the time.
So it was kind of like, you know, Ed was living next door to Lou Henson. You know,
kind of like that. He, the superintendent's office is like an old house right next to their house. Yeah, anyway.
Interesting. Well.
Hmm.
The things you learn in this podcast. Mine is a much lighter social media update here this week. I think we've discussed David Ross, former Cubs catcher, is on Dancing with the Stars.
Boo.
And I have not watched any of it. However, Rossi's having a lot of fun with this. He tweeted out a GIF a couple days ago that simply said, "Sweet dreams." At Anthony Rizzo 44, Cubs first baseman Anthony Rizzo, and it's a shot of Ross looking back over his shoulder while he massages his buttock. And Rizzo, I thought, had a nice response to that. He simply said, at Cubs, can we enforce a dress code for front office employees? This does not fall under the Joe Madden rule. If you think you look hot, wear it. So just some fun interaction between a couple of former teammates. David Ross does now work in the front office, and so they're having a good time with it. So that's my fun social media status update this week. So
that's definitely lighter.
Indeed it
is. Good.
And that's going to wrap things up here for today. But before we go, we've got credits.
Oh, my gosh. We talked so much today. But it was amusing and fun. Thanks, guys. Also, thank you. Thank you for joining us on the bandwagon. We'd also like to thank Isaac Musgrave, because he's, like, famous now.
Woot.
So thanks for the interview, Isaac. We'll probably talk to you again as you get more and more famous. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. Other people who've helped make Bandwagon happen, Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and, of course, R.E.M., they performed the theme music, in case you hadn't figured that out. Anyway, you can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon, where we link to almost everything we discuss here on the podcast, or on the pod, as some people like to call it. Videos, audio, social media accounts, much more. You can also subscribe to the Bandwagon and rate it in iTunes. If you rate us, that really helps other people find us. And, you know, we want to be found. I mean, we would like to be found. So please help us out. No iTunes, no big deal. Find us pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast. There are no vowels in that Twitter handle, so leave them out. You'll get our most recent thoughts on stuff. We also all have our own Twitter accounts, and you can follow each of us if you want to. Send us your links, recommendations, topics of conversation. We would love that. We'll be back soon, a couple of weeks or so, for another episode. And until then, thanks for playing.